This is Radio Free Potato, May 16th, 2012.
Remember, remember the 5th of November, the gunpowder, treason, and plot. I know of no reason why the gunpowder treason should ever be forgot.
Radio Free Potato here, episode number 2. I hope everyone out there has had a great and wonderful... How long ago was the last episode of RFP? You know, I don't even remember at this point, but it was far longer ago than I'd intended, and I am sorry for that. But sometimes these things just happen, and then hopefully we move on. Even though it was a few months ago, I did have a great holiday season. I wanted to say that because mainly, you may not believe it now, but when you get my age, the best part of the holidays is the food, which is why I'm going to be an old man who is fat. And so will you. Even if you're a girl, you will turn into an old man who is fat. Trust me on this one. I hope everyone made it through the winter okay and is now enjoying a nice spring filled with pretty flowers and chirping birds and as few bees as possible because they are evil. I want to send a comforting word or two to the poor souls up in the north who always wind up spending every winter on the planet Hoth. I know what northern winters are like, and believe me, you have my deepest sympathies. Stay warm up there if you can. Always keep your fire stoked and do not park your Tauntauns in Detroit, or you'll come back and they'll be on cement blocks with no legs. Just kind of making that Tauntaun noise and looking like bowling pins with horns. Trust me, I've lost a few perfectly good Tauntauns that way when I lived there. when I think about it, I almost feel like a deserter in a way. Here I am, I'm in Los Angeles now, and the flowers outside my house bloom even in the dead of January. There are flowers here. It gets up to around 70 degrees during the day, and only about the mid-40s at night, and that's about the worst of it. And for me, I think my brain has tried its best to bury the idea that there are places out there on this planet that can get so cold that you can actually die just from standing somewhere that isn't inside a house. That does not seem right to me. That should not be legal. Because I admit, one of the big reasons that I moved to California was because I can't stand the cold. It hurts my soul. And after 5 years in Michigan and another 2 in Wisconsin earlier in my life, I'm just done with winter. I could never see a snowflake again in my life, and I would die a happy old fat man. And now here I am. The birds are singing and the sun's shining and wild deer are running around singing "The Hills Are Alive." And I think about some of my friends back there in the north whose butts are freezing and breaking off. And I'll admit there is some guilt there. I kind of feel like when you have to leave some of your friends in the middle of the zombie apocalypse to be munched on, you know, and you know they're back there, probably having to beat these things down with baseball bats, and you're somewhere else being served champagne and etouffee, you know, in a nice restaurant with no dead people around at all. And, you know, you're sitting there thinking, well, thank crap I'm out of there, but do hope the old fellows have managed not to have their brains chewed upon. I swear the guilt does not last long because I think about cold and, well, I figure someone's got to be warm. Might as well be me, you know? My distaste of freezing has actually been the source of an interesting discovery that I recently made. Some years back, I was describing my dislike for winter with someone I just met, and for the first time, I heard these enigmatic, disturbing words come out of another human being. Oh, well, I love the cold. Now, I know that everyone has different opinions. Most of the time, you know, no one's right and no one's wrong. It's just a difference in preferences. Sometimes other people's ideas don't agree with yours, and sometimes they do. But this was different because this was just crazy talk. I love the cold, and this person is allowed to walk around amongst sane people. Something has got to be wrong here. When I go out in the cold, the first thing that happens is pain. And in no conceivable way is it a good pain. This is a cruel, needly pain wherever the air touches my skin. It's hard to breathe because my lungs keep trying to kick the air back out, thinking I've gone crazy and I'm trying to breathe some toxic vapors. Any part of my body that's exposed for more than a few minutes gets a low, dull ache. And if I stay out long enough, my ears begin to hurt like someone has put a Star Trek mind control grub in my skull. After 20 minutes, I'm ready to fly to Regular One and steal the damn Genesis device. It's like wearing a tweed suit with a hangover and no undergarments for me. And I'm standing in front of a person who's telling me that he likes this. Well, I dismissed it. This person is just trying to make himself out to be tough or cool by saying he likes something that no one could possibly like. He's trying to be different, that's all. Or at least I thought. Because from that time until now, I have met far too many legions of people who claim to stand up and cheer for joy when it starts snowing outside. In fact, I can safely say that I've met more people who claim to love being in the cold than who hate it. Well, this began to disturb me. Did I have some kind of crazy rare medical condition that caused me to feel miserable in cold temperatures that I caught from some strange South American tropical chicken? I knew I shouldn't have touched that damn chicken. The folks who like the cold talk about temperatures like they're on the verge of melting into a puddle of drug-induced ecstasy. They talk about the cold like they could sit in it and stab their own livers with a kitchen knife, obliviously giggling the whole time. Was I missing out on an awesome party here? I didn't understand. And I don't like not understanding something. So I did what I learned to do when I don't understand something. I ask questions. It wasn't enough anymore that I put the local booby hatch on speed dial and hoped the men in white coats were fast enough to chase down these loonies if they decided to start talking to invisible, abominable snowmen. I wanted to know why. So I began asking. And right away, I found the answer was virtually the same every time, with about three variations. I like the cold because A, it's perfect for snuggling with my sweetheart. 2, I can curl up in the fireplace and it's cozy. And D, I can bundle up under my covers in bed. Well, immediately I'm thinking, that's loving warmth, not cold. In almost every case when a person said they love the cold, it was directly so they could have an excuse to be warm. And as I was questioning a friend about this recently, I accidentally stumbled onto something that taught me just a little bit more about humanity and myself. He also claimed to love the cold, and I shared my findings with him. Not only do you love the warmth, I said, you seek warmth because you actually dislike the cold. In fact, people who say they love the cold are actually just looking for an excuse to force themselves to be warm. My friend looked at me and he said, yeah, I'd say that's a fair judgment. I said, okay, then if that's the case, aren't you forced to be warm in the summertime? And then he said something that I continue to ponder and may well for the rest of my days. He said, but if it's cold, then I have the choice. Do we, as a species, actually need to know we have control over whether we're comfortable or miserable? If placed in a situation where we have no choice to be happy, would we feel more comfortable knowing that we could be unhappy if we desired it? Have we created a world with an ambiance of droning misery so that we can more enjoy the pockets of happiness and still know that we have a choice? Is being able to choose happiness actually more important than happiness itself? And suddenly, I thought about my move from Michigan to California. Sure, it was cold there, but was it that bad? Not really. In fact, there's some things about Michigan that I miss. But more than being cold and more than having a bad economy and an absolutely spectacular crime rate, more than any other complaint I had about Michigan, I felt trapped there. I felt like I was losing my choice to be somewhere else if I wanted to. Did I move away from Michigan just so that I could exercise my control when I felt I was losing it? Did I choose to move because I needed to be able to choose? People sometimes prefer the cold so they can have a choice. Did I leave the cold for the same reason? Did I leave one choice simply to prove to myself that I could choose? When I think about it, I suppose that choosing happiness is more comfortable to all of us than just happiness alone. At least those are my thoughts. Something I'd like to tell everyone about. I go to a lot of conventions, and not just furry conventions. I go to Trek cons and gaming cons and anything resembling a food con, because I am a raging fanboy for food, if I have not mentioned it yet. I would turn down hanging out with Kate Mulgrew for some pie. Seriously, there's a chocolate convention in the LA area. You should come. It's orgasmic. But I'm getting off the topic. One of the things that makes furry conventions a bit different is that they usually support some kind of charity, which I think is a totally righteous thing to do. They have auctions where artwork and fun items are donated, and they have a stage auction, and they make a show out of it, and then that money, it goes to the charity to help out their cause. Now, usually, the cause is saving animals who are sick or dying or in trouble. A lot of times it's something like Wolf Park or Tiger Haven or some kind of animal sanctuary that rescues and saves injured animals that would have to be killed in any other situation. And they keep those animals and they feed them and they make sure they have the happiest lives they can give them. All very groovy, in my opinion. But a few years ago, I was in the planning stage of a convention that I was running at the time, and I looked around and I realized that all of this charity money was going towards keeping animals fed and housed. None of it was going to any other areas of animal-based studies like scientific research. And to me, that just seemed crazy that none of these conventions were supporting animal research. And now when I say animal research, I don't mean slapping a rhesus monkey with a Stouffer's frozen meatloaf 1,200 times to see if it'll give it gonorrhea. I'm not talking about keeping animals in cages and testing chemicals on them or anything like that. I was more fascinated by human-animal relations, like intelligence and communication. And for whatever reason, I've tried for years to find a way to support a nonprofit organization that I've followed called the Alex Foundation. And it just, we didn't have the space for the charity that year, and it just didn't work out. And so it was very unfortunate. But what this group does is they train African gray parrots not just to speak, but to comprehend what they're saying and what others are saying to them. Now, you might be thinking, bah, it's a damn bird. We're people. We don't even know what we're saying half the time. And you're saying the tropical chicken over there can actually learn English. Bah, I say bah. Well, that's what much of the scientific community thought, too, before the Alex Foundation came around. They wound up making some major breakthroughs in what we know about animals and their intelligence.
Patrick, you're right. Good boy.
Alex describing objects. Alex saying, Polly want more than a cracker.
Is what you want?
I want banana. Carrot.
Good birdie.
I want corn. Soft corn.
Soft corn. Good parent. We've got rock corn, that's dried corn, and we've got soft corn, too.
Cold?
It's cold, yes, it's cold. It's from the refrigerator.
Cold
Using his beak, he could tell you what matter objects were made of.
Rock? Good boy.
Rock.
What matter?
Wood.
Good boy.
And amazingly, on a tray, he could tell you the number of squares from the number of balls, the number of each color.
How many blue blocks?
Four
is right.
Good parrot.
Okay. He's choosing from among all the possible answers. Remember, he sees this object. If he was giving a knee-jerk response, he would say paper every time he saw this thing.
He tried to restrain himself when student parrots like this one got it wrong.
What matter?
Then Alex would interject with his equivalent of duh.
What matter?
What? That's right.
Good.
As parrots go, he was simply Einstein. When we were there, even Einstein got hungry.
Well, you're a good boy.
Want to go eat dinner?
I know. It's time to eat dinner, sweetie.
So here's an organization that actually effectively teaches animals how to talk and to understand people. And I was just amazed that the furry community wasn't just throwing insane piles of money at this thing. Imagine an animal that could tell you what it wanted. How it felt, what it thinks about Chinese macrame. Now, don't misunderstand me. I think that donating to the sanctuaries is a wonderful and worthwhile way to help. However, it dawned on me that if it takes $100,000 to feed and house a wounded bear all its life, even if it lives until it dies of old age, it's still going to die. And all that money has gone for the welfare and comfort of one creature. But funding research like this, that's knowledge, and that lasts forever. I know it's a very clinical way of looking at it all, but it just seems to me like there should be more charity money put toward this kind of animal understanding. So I want to encourage everyone to check out the Alex Foundation, do a little studying online about it, see what you like. And if you're as excited as I am about what they're doing and you want to toss a few bucks their way, then, you know, there might be a chance that the birds in the future will just start yelling insults at us instead of crapping on our cars, which I think would be a much better deal for all of us. If you want more information about the Alex Foundation, you can find their website at www.alexfoundation.org. If you do contact them, please tell them that you heard it here on Radio Free Potato. Life is full of little setbacks. Anyone will tell you that. Sometimes they're caused by great and mysterious forces in life that are challenging you to move forward and solve your problems and seize every day for everything it can be. And sometimes they're caused by your busybody community manager who doesn't appreciate the fact that you have a studio in your garage. Apparently, my beautifully gated community has some crazy rule that you have to be able to park a car in your garage. Doesn't matter if you even have a car, you still have to be able to park one there, which to me is like the absolute worst use for a garage. I don't know your feelings on it, but I'm hoping that you feel the same here. The biggest room in the whole house with a huge door, all for one machine to just sit there and think about things that cars think about. Oil, that squirrel they pulverized, you know, writing hateful poetry about the fuel additives at the Arco station on Maglin Avenue, stuff like that. Well, I'm guessing an employee looked in the window and took a dim view of the fact that you couldn't park a car in my garage without it being on top of a small TV station, so they wrote me up, and I'm pretty sure from the wording of the notice that they really just wanted me to get rid of the studio. I don't think they liked it being in here. And they probably figured that, you know, if they told me that I had to be able to park a car in there, I'd just have to take everything out and put it somewhere else. But I'm a clinical smartass. I try to embrace the attributes of smartassity. So for an entire 2 weeks I spent, I actually managed to rearrange the entire garage where the studio is still here, but you can park a car in it too. So, yeah, I have a problem with authority. I'm sure they won't like me much for that, but, you know, it complies with their rules, and, well, I have to have a studio because I have a lot of work to do this year. First, hey, I want to thank all the viewers of the 2 Cents Show for joining us again for our new season. We've had a lot of fun with it so far. I hope you've enjoyed the new co-hosts that we have. We have Callis, who's he's young, but he's really a lot of fun. I really picture that guy going somewhere if he can harness his talents. And of course, we got Firechild, professional radio DJ talk show host, and she is amazing. She is just absolutely amazing. If you haven't watched, you can go on to Ustream and watch the actual on-demand replay of the show that she did. She's absolutely amazing. We're going to have her back. She's coming back on a regular basis, so you get to see her again. Actually, if I hadn't had to rearrange the studio, the show would have started a bit earlier, but, you know, hey, at least it's going now. If you want to see me perform my comedy show live on stage in front of thousands of people and extremely nervous... I'll be in Pittsburgh for Anthrocon on, I think it starts on June 14th. I'm not sure. Well, go to the website and find out for sure because I'm not sure. It's www.anthrocon.org. And just to let you know, this will be the first performance of my new 2012 stand-up material. And I'll also be releasing my latest DVD there for anyone who cares to buy it, along with a few new items that I hope will be fun, like shot glasses. Because how can you not like shot glasses? I actually ordered a bunch of shot glasses. The last people I heard of who did not like shot glasses, the terrorists. Yep. If you don't like shot glasses, then the terrorists win. So I'm bringing some to Anthrocon with me in case you guys want to buy some. Also, there will be some new shows and segments coming out that some of you might enjoy, I hope, anyway. I'm going to give Seven the Snob Griffin a little show of his own, which should be, well, I don't know. We'll see how that goes. If you remember Seven the Snob Griffin, I'll also have some new rants for YouTube soon and some new LSD files for those of you who have been waiting for more of those for years now. Just to let you know, I've had about 10 of those written and ready to go for years now, and I just have not sat down to record them. I have time now, so guess what? They're getting recorded. I'm hoping that this will be one of my most productive years in a long time, and I'm going to have fun, and I definitely hope the folks out there will have some fun with me, because that's just really all I want. I want you guys to have fun with me. I want to have fun. You guys have fun. Everybody has fun. And we all win. I have a reading for you today from my biography. A lot of people ask me how I arrived at my current state of faith or lack thereof. I am an agnostic, or as some people call it nowadays, an atheist. And I used to be a Christian minister. Well, understandably, people have been curious about this. It was a significant part of my life, and it is part of my biography that I am writing, and hopefully will finish before I am too old and fat to type. So here is excerpt from my biography on exactly this portion of my life, and I hope you enjoy it. To anyone who has never experienced the death of a close family member, let me try to explain what it's like. You've probably heard other people describe it before. They use words like difficult, devastating. They say things like, you never truly get over it, but it gets better with time. Or, it feels like there's an empty space inside you. The fact is, the words and phrases people use when they're asked about such a thing are just reflexes. Memorized statements, if you will. Mental sound bites in the absence of any sliver of hope to accurately convey such a permeating experience. Placeholders for the indescribable. The reality is far more involved. First comes the actual death. That is the moment you discover, in whatever way, that your family member has indeed kicked the bucket. This may come in many different forms, from receiving a phone call from the police to walking in the bathroom and noticing a body face down on the floor when there wasn't one there just a little while ago. And as much of a surprise as it is to most people, this is the easy part. The immediate reaction is to simply continue on with your day, as though you've discovered a broken taillight on your car or a parking ticket on your windshield. It's inconvenient, and yes, it's upsetting, but you can deal with it later. Just because Grandma is face down somewhere in the hallway doesn't mean those bills are going to pay themselves. This is the first phase, which lasts, unfortunately, only a few minutes. The next thing you notice is that no matter how much you feel like you should, you actually can't continue on with your day even when you try. Because for some reason, you simply can't think. The tendrils you send into your brain to retrieve the whereabouts of your car keys, your supervisor's phone number, the procedures involved in making a peanut butter and jelly sandwich, and how to read the next sentence in a newspaper article are all returned with an eerie, foreshadowing silence. As if all the connections in your head have just been shut down. This phase can last from around 30 minutes to an hour. The third stage comes about when you abandon trying to continue on as though you weren't just informed someone you've loved your whole life has been, for example, melted by a falling high-tension power line, and find yourself with nothing else to do but sit and ponder. And suddenly, out of the emptiness comes pouring more emotions at once than is even possible to name. A caustic cacophony of mixed feelings like battery acid being pumped backwards through your bloodstream, enough to make you feel rug burned from the inside out. The hyperstimulation of this jagged storm of emotions alone is enough to make you feel like you've fallen into a large pile of ice-cold needles. At this point, the elapsed time has been about 2 hours. The next phase lasts 20 years. Because the fact is, whatever hallowed fathoms of despair and loss you have to claw your way out of when you lose a brother, a sister, mother or father, the true cruelty of experiencing this through a sentient perception is that you don't have to do it just once. You do it 1,000 times. Because you see, the mind can forget, but the heart has addictions. And a few days after the funeral, when you find that movie you and your dead loved one wanted to see finally released in the store, you will, if only for a few seconds, be excited to bring this movie home and share the time watching it with the person you've lost. You will, for just a moment, forget this person has died. It may only be a small shard of time, but when the reality sinks back in that this person is gone and they're never coming back, you experience the loss all over again, as though it had just happened. And this happens over and over and over, for weeks, months, years. You may find yourself having dialed the first 2 numbers of your dead mother's phone number, or heard what you thought was her footsteps coming down the hallway. You may find yourself anticipating your dead father's return home when you see it's nearly 6 o'clock. Or you may find an old Christmas present they gave you. And each time, if only for a fraction of a second, you will live in a world where your loved one is still alive. And then, when you remember, you relive those ice-cold needles. A dead loved one is like a phantom limb that continues to itch years after it's been amputated, because some small part of you simply keeps forgetting that it's gone. My father died in 1992, just about 20 years ago. He'd become ill from a heart condition that quickly became unrecoverable. He died at home in his sleep. And to this day, 20 years later, I will still find him occasionally in my dreams, casually sharing his existence with me as though he'd never been gone. And I wake up, and he dies again. This was my father, the guiding rock of my life since I could comprehend time, the protector of the family, the high authority from which came knowledge, judgment, and direction. And suddenly, he was gone. So if this is what it's like to lose a father, what must it be like then to lose a god? For those who don't know, being a Christian feels wonderful. You are a disguised superhero shuffling around amongst mortal men with the knowledge that you were meant for something special. You're a mysterious stranger with a magical secret. At the peak of my Christianity, I could actually feel love radiating from what I believed was the creator of the universe. I was being watched over, protected, and guided directly by the CEO of everything. The frightening prospect of having to decide what was good and bad, right and wrong, was deferred to the highest authority. I didn't have to make my own decisions. Life was laid out in a straight, simple plan. And when I reached the end of that life, I would open my eyes to a place so beautiful it can't even be described, with all my loved ones there to share it with me while I lived in absolute happiness for eternity. Being a Christian, it's sometimes all you can do to keep from singing for joy. Can you blame them? Until my mid-20s, I'd never known a life without this. I was born and raised with an almighty, eternally loving, and all-powerful protector continually overhead. I never questioned it or even thought about it. It just was. And I wanted nothing more than to use my life in thanks of everything God had done for us humans down here. Since my father was a minister, I started having an interest in being a minister too. When I was 9, I handed my father a short sermon I'd written. He actually made it part of the service that Sunday. When I was 11, he let me write half the sermon for a Wednesday night service and deliver it myself at the pulpit. By the time I was in my mid-teens, I was delivering almost as many full sermons as my father was, and I was good at it. I would hear members of the congregation comment to each other when they knew I could hear. "He's a young prodigy, that one. That boy's got the spirit of Christ in him." I couldn't have been more proud of myself. One Sunday, a small group of ministers came from a nearby county to visit our congregation and listen to the service. This was nothing unusual. Only this time, I got to join the group afterwards along with my father in the traditional meeting of the ministers, which always happened behind closed doors. I'd always been curious what went on in these hallowed gatherings, and as I entered the small room once the congregation had left, I truly felt like I'd earned my way into something special. The visiting ministers were very polite and well-dressed, and we chatted for a while about their congregations and told a few inspirational stories. Then, something strange happened. One of the ministers rose from his seat, opened the door, and inspected the hallway suspiciously. When he saw the church was empty, he said, "Hey, great idea getting your son in on the act." A couple of the other ministers chimed in to agree. My father looked at me as though I was a coveted pulpit dynamo. "Well, he puts a lot of work behind it," he said. One of the other ministers ruffled my hair. "I bet you two are really cleaning up." He grinned, looking between me and my father. Cleaning up? Occasionally, my father would make me come down and help him sweep the church floor, but mostly there was a girl who volunteered to clean up and we didn't have to. Why would he ask about cleaning up? I was confused. Later that night, my father asked me into his office. He told me that just because someone says they're a minister doesn't mean they're really in the service of God. Sometimes ministers can be bad people, sinners, people who pretend to be saved but are really going to hell. I wasn't sure what he meant at the time, but as I laid awake that night in bed pondering what happened, my brain began to do something that is very dangerous for a Christian. It began to think. Tithing, the act of giving one-tenth of your income to your church in support. Customary and often expected for each family and Christian congregations throughout the United States. No matter the sect or denomination, the church passes the plate, the money goes in. The average household income in the 80s was $45,000 annually. One-tenth of that is $4,500. As half of the churches in the United States have 100 members or more, and the average family size is 4 members, that leaves approximately 150,000 churches with 25 families or more each, all giving $4,500 a year. Punch those numbers into your 80s Texas Instruments computer and the number you get back is $112,500. Raise the number of church members to just 500 and that figure is just over $500,000 a year. For one small building that uses electricity only a few hours a week, is usually maintained by volunteers, pays no rent, and no taxes. Is something wrong with this picture? For years, I willingly omitted this discovery from my mind and continued on as though it never happened. What I didn't know was that night, the CEO of everything contracted a disease, the ultimate outcome of which would eventually be terminal. And the prognosis didn't improve as I began visiting other churches sometime later, as the ministers had done with mine that day. And in the privacy of the ministers' offices after the service, I would visit them pastor to pastor, and I would ask them if they were cleaning up. The answers I got were exactly what I prayed I wouldn't hear. New Cadillacs, jacuzzis, summer trips to Jakarta, Barcelona, Las Vegas. One minister was more than happy to croon about his new in-ground swimming pool. All this money wasn't vanishing. It was going right into the pockets of the ministers, the elders, and quite often the treasurers, to keep them tossing a few extra figures in the books by flashlight in the wee hours of the morning. Regards for the congregation that was supplying these entrepreneurs with their cash flow ranged from quiet amusement at their misdirected dedication to outright scathing joviality at these delusional pigeons who were paying thousands of dollars for nothing. Most of the ministers didn't even believe in the Bible from which they preached. It was a scam, a hustle, a con. The universe, as I'd always known it was, at its shadowy core, a marketing scheme. Using a 3,000-year-old boogeyman to scare suckers into giving their money and selling them a false sense of morals and hope for cash. If anyone asked where the money was going, they were simply told it was going to help build a church for the poor, godless South American village of Duwachum Boogie, or to feed starving children in the remote, unreachable, uncontactable Piggly Wiggly tribe deep in the African rainforest. And why would they lie? These were ministers, after all. They'd even order fake pamphlets, customized with their church's name, that showed pictures of starving children with food that the congregation had so generously provided, or pictures of that essential medical tent healing the sick in the middle of nowhere. And this monstrous practice was present at not some, not most, but all 13 churches I visited. And none of the congregations ever suspected a thing. I couldn't believe it. I was crushed. At the time, I didn't even know corruption like this existed outside of the mafia or Hollywood, much less at the core of my untouchable beliefs. For me, at this point, God was still alive, but his condition had been moved to serious. I stopped preaching, even stopped going to church every Sunday. About a year before my father's death, I attended my final Christian church service. I just couldn't bring myself to go anymore. I tried to embrace the notion that if there was a Christian God, the last thing he'd want would be for people to be worshiping in these false temple abominations erected not to pay tribute to him, but to someone's bank account. I spent the next couple of years keeping God on life support. There simply had to be a God. How could anything make sense without one? He just wasn't where I thought he was. I spent those years, as many future atheists do, in a state of desperate spirit-seeking. If God wasn't with the Christians, where was he? I spent time studying and practicing as many different belief systems as I felt I could. Wicca, Hindu, Judaism. I even spent several months with a Native American Lakota tribe worshiping the Great Spirit. None of it felt right anymore. It was then that the thinking part of my brain came in for the kill. If everyone believed that their God and their path was the only true one, then either God was with everyone, or he was with no one. And from what I'd seen, I knew damn well he wasn't with everyone. It was the darkest, most frightening, most chilling thought I'd ever had. And nothing had felt more tragically correct. It was time to let God go. In the summer of 1994, I walked out into my yard at 3 a.m, looked up at the stars, and I prayed to God one last time. Dear God, this will be the last time I talk to you, because the biggest thing that the path to you has taught me is that you're not there. Now, I realize I could be wrong, And if I am, then I ask you, Lord, to please forgive me. But if you gave people intelligence, and that intelligence shows them that you don't exist, there's only one direction to go. I'll miss you, God. And I'll hope to my dying day that I'm wrong. But until then, I have to say goodbye. In Jesus' name, amen. And then, God was dead. For the first day, I continued on as though nothing had happened, but eventually, it all sunk in. And then, nothing made sense anymore. My whole world was turned upside down. Nothing was familiar. Literally everything I looked at was no longer what it used to be. I was lost, confused, alone, and cheated out of eternity. As with any death, it got easier over time. After the initial shock, I found that I was far more comfortable in a godless universe. But to this day, years later, I sometimes miss God like an old friend. And the experience of losing a God is something I never want to inflict on anyone else. That's why, if you see atheists descending upon a Christian chat room trying to browbeat them with logic, you won't see me amongst them. In the end, Christianity doesn't make people bad. Bad people will be bad whether they're Christians or not. If you take God away from a judgmental, cruel Christian, you'll get a judgmental, cruel atheist. Turning people from their religions doesn't help make the world a better place. And if the atheists are right, and none of us go on to any eternal paradise when we die, then what does it matter what anyone believes about gods and afterlives? If we're all going to wind up in a hole in the ground, then there'll be no way to gloat that you were right. Everyone is guilty of living a lie sometimes. But if someone is lucky enough to be living one that makes them happy, why take it away from them? I want to make a note here that I'm positive that there are many churches out there who conduct themselves honestly and actually believe in the Bible. The church I ministered for was one of them. This was just my own personal experience, and it certainly doesn't mean that every Christian out there is in the same situation. However, if you are the church-going type and you have concerns about your church, I would suggest starting your own. Because, as it says in the Bible, Matthew chapter 18, verse 20, I believe, because where two or three have come together in my name, I am there among them. Speaking of donating money, I just wanted to say how absolutely floored I am by the fundraiser that the furry fandom recently had for Fernando's Cafe. If you're not a furry and you don't know what recently happened, it's kind of was contained within the fandom. Fernando's is a small business in the center of Pittsburgh, and for the last few years, they have been very welcoming and very friendly to the furries who show up for Anthrocon in the summer, which is something that furries do remember, because, to be honest, a lot of people are instantly, they're automatically hostile to furries. They're automatically judgmental. The furries honestly just want to come together to have a good time, to share their interests in animation, in costuming and mascotting. And, they wind up coming to towns like this a lot of time. They're instantly judged. They're instantly demonized. And, this business they set up, and they just welcomed them. They welcomed them right in the doors. And, that we remembered that the furries remembered that. They, as I've always said, furries remember their enemies and they remember their friends, and they remember them both very well. Unfortunately, because of the economy, it's been so unfriendly lately. The shop is not going to be able to remain in business. However, when the furries heard about this, They passed a hat, the proverbial hat, and at last count had gathered $25,000 of their own money that they just gave to help Fernando stay in business a little longer and settle his debts. And it was just it was a wonderful thing to see and be a part of. And I think the moral here is to never stand between furries and their food, even if you're the economy. Are you the economy? Guess what? We will kick your ass. Do not stand in front of furries and their food, or they will tear you a new ass. End of story. I will be having a private gathering at Anthrocon, as I promised, for those who donated $100 or more to the Fernandos. And at the moment, we have about 50 people, which that was something we did not expect. We were thinking we'd wind up with a cozy little soiree in our hotel room. And, well, now obviously we're going to need a bigger place unless we all plan to jump in a blender and just, you know, have them pump us in there. So looks like we're going to wind up with part of the function space in the Westin Hotel. It should be a laid-back gathering. It'll be your chance to meet and talk with me if that's what you like to do. And Toast the Rabbit, for those of you who know him. Also Uncle Kage. And whomever else we can shove in there for a little while. And don't quote me on this because it's not a promise. But if things go right and the feeling is going well, there might just be an opportunity for a secret show sometime that night. The show that actually inspired this particular show, the RFP. But we'll see. We will see. For now, I'm going to close this episode of RFP with the hope. I'm not going to promise this because I've learned better, but the sincere hope that you'll hear from me on episode 3 soon. So take care and thanks for listening. And do remember, don't touch the tropical chickens. Radio Free Potato is copyright 2012, Ranting Griffin Studios. If you have any questions or would like to contact us, please write to 2@ranting-griffin.com or visit our website at www.ranting-griffin.com.